This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time, and soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Welcome to today's podcast conversation. This podcast is indeed about your future, and we spend most of our time talking about things that you can implement, strategies, ideas, tactics to prepare for the other side of retirement. But retirement won't take place in isolation. There's a broader context. And today we're going to zoom out a bit, look at the big picture, and talk with an expert about megatrends that are creating that context for your retirement and what that will mean for you. My guest is Bradley Sherman. He's a demographic futurist and opinion maker on all things dealing with the business of longevity. He's the author of the new book, The Super Age, Decoding Our Demographic Destiny, as well as the co-founder and president of Kiba, an inclusive design firm dedicated to improving the built environment with a focus on housing, hospitality, and the workplace. Prior to launching his entrepreneurial journey, he worked for AARP, where he led global partnerships. He's responsible for the groundbreaking AARP Aging Readiness and Competitiveness Report, as well as for developing AARP's relationships with the Asian Development Bank, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and the World Economic Forum. Bradley is a social connector that has built his reputation by helping leading organizations harness the economic and social opportunities of our increasingly older and generationally diverse populations. He speaks regularly at in-person events, and his insights regularly inform media, national leaders, and corporate executives in the U.S. and around the world.
So Bradley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So we just heard your bio, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and your journey in writing the Super Age book.
The Super Age book was really a 25-year endeavor, I suppose, Joe. It started out as a point of fascination for me, aging populations, demographic change. It migrated into a career working for Leading Age and AARP, two of the larger aging-related organizations in the country and certainly in the world as well. And it ended with me departing AARP to start my own company, The Super Age, and then to write this book that I felt was desperately needed in the marketplace of ideas. There are, and there have been, many books that express our aging population in a good way. There are great books that talk about this new middle age or a new way to get older in America and perhaps around the world, but they tend to dive in head first. And with this book, I wanted to step back and give a broader audience, a business audience, but then a broader audience, a perspective of what this demographic change means outside of an older population. Because when we get caught up on old, we can't see the larger picture. And the reality is we have two significant megatrends colliding right now. And they're colliding with an absolute colossal force that's decreased birth rates that are dropping year on year and increased longevity. We continue to get older as averages, but also as individuals. And that's remaking the map. That's remaking society. That's remaking economy. And it will affect, it's already affecting all of us. None of us have escaped it yet.
So these two megatrends, longevity, demographics, what are the big ways in which it will continue to change the world that we live in aging?
Yeah, well, I think starting with maybe the broader picture of demographic change, what it means for us, all of us. The real kind of tipping point happened around the turn of the last century. So around 1900 is when things really started to speed up. And this happened during the Second Industrial Revolution, 1870 to 1914, where we had all of these dramatic innovations, mostly to food safety, to water safety. Vaccine development started in earnest. We really got under the idea that we should save children. We should allow children to get into adulthood. Because at the time, one out of four died before the age of one, one out of three before the age of five, and nearly half by the age of adulthood. Those are terrible odds, absolutely terrible odds. And what we did in the West, and then we shared it with the world, is we virtually erased infant and youth mortality. What this did was it caused our global population to explode. So we went from about 2 billion people around then to 8 billion people today. So demographics had a lot of effect on the global economy. It's also forced us into a position where we're struggling with resources, environmental resources. So when people think that the current state of the environment is just because we're using too many fossil fuels or plastics or what have you, we are, but there's just a lot more of us around to do it. So the problem multiplies exponentially. Because of the slowing of the birth rates, we're actually going to see global populations stop growing by sometime this century. And in fact, in some countries today, that's already happened. Japan, believe it or not, is a country that's already in population decline. There are counties in the U.S. that are already in population decline. There are states within the U.S. that already meet this super age designation, which is one out of five people over the age of 65, and those are Maine, Vermont, Delaware, West Virginia, and Florida. What it means for an older population, though, is that we have to innovate because we simply don't have the same number of people behind us. So if we're thinking about the care sector, for example, there aren't enough hands to do the jobs. So we have to think about robotics. We have to think about artificial intelligence. We have to confront our concerns over immigration. But none of these are standalone solutions for what could be a potential problem. We're also doing something that's quite unique. Because of these really incredible enhancements to life, because we have preventative health now, because we're taking greater control over our well-being, how we eat, we do have these wonderful vaccines that keep us from getting sick. We're living healthier longer too. So a person who's 65, which is the traditional kind of line of old versus young, has really been wiped away. We still use it because it's legislated. But in reality, though, a 65-year-old person today, on average, presents a lot younger. And I say younger, don't think just physically looking young. They are physically more fit, they are cognitively more strong, and they're mentally with it than a generation ago and a generation before that. So everyone gets so hung up on this adage, you know, 50 is the new 40. To some degree, that's right. But just counting the number of years that you've been on this planet is now just a terrible measure. It probably was never a good one, but it's really, really bad now.
One chapter in your book, I really appreciated the title of it, Make Home and Community Gray Again. What's your vision of what that could look like in the future?
Well, we do best when we have and live within diverse environments. And our communities, due in large part to, I think, well-intentioned folks, really around the middle centuries when we saw this come into full effect, said, the modern family's changed. There should be a mom, a dad, and two kids that live within a home. Grandma and grandpa should live on their own, perhaps in the neighborhood or not. And when it's time, as an individual or as a couple, you should move into a retirement community. And that really was the model that we leaned into for, I mean, basically 30 to 40 years. We said this was okay from like the 1960s to the 1990s. Where we thought this was the way to go. My grandparents went into a retirement community. There's nothing wrong with that. But we realized that we weren't actually better off for it. There's an out of sight, out of mind attitude that developed. And when communities were only presenting as young, they missed, I think, some richness to them. But we spent most of the last century, post-war period, really pushing older people out. It wasn't necessarily a stated goal, but it was the effect. So pensions were in place. Well, then it was easier for an employer to say to an older worker, well, you can go away now. You can take retirement. You can get money from the government and your strong pension. We had, you know, really effective marketing teams saying, come live here amongst your peers and your friends and relax and enjoy the sun while not working. And people bought into that. but it wasn't necessarily good for folks at the end of the day. But that marketing was so good that people bought into it. I certainly think that the pandemic really showed people that type of living really isn't for everyone.
So when you think about the super age, what do you see as the major upsides?
I mean, there are more upsides than I think downsides, but they're only upsides if we lean into them. Okay. On the surface, you know, the super age or super aged countries, which is a UN designation of 1 out of 5 people over the age of 65 within a nation, these were really considered to be a pejorative designation. This is when they said, yeah, everything's going to start falling off the rails then. You know, you're going to lose your pensions and the healthcare system's going to collapse and there'll be a complete imbalance in the labor force. And yeah, it's just going to be terrible for everyone everywhere. And yes, it will be if we do nothing. But if we turn ourselves around and say, well, there are more older people, but they are healthier than they've ever been before. Maybe they should be working longer. Maybe we should open up new pathways for employment or people like you who go back to school and take on new careers in the second half or maybe the third or the fourth quarter. These are all very doable things for us. The nice thing about a long life is that our needs change. And some people look at these as negatives. I mean, obviously, health conditions change and people get frustrated with those. People certainly lament, you know, sometimes their gray hair or their wrinkles. But with that comes new opportunities for products and services to be delivered. And that's a good thing, at least for the economy at large. I mean, I know today I'm 44 years old. I'm entering middle age. Products that I need today are vastly different than those that I needed 20 years ago. That's not a value judgment on what I need. It just is. The challenge, though, is that we've always been able to build products well for kids. We've always been able to build products for people younger than us because we had that lived experience. The challenge with building products and services for older people is that we have to actively include them in the design process. They have to be central to the iteration, the ideation, all of those components that are built in. We have to ask them on a regular basis, does this sound good to you? Do you enjoy the way the product works with you? And if we're really smart, we think about them as part of a larger design process, as companies like Apple and Peloton do with such great flair. They're one part of their consumer base, not an exclusive one. And when people can feel part of the whole, part of the tribe, they're better off at the end of the day.
So there's always the flip side, as you alluded to. Mm-hmm. What are the biggest challenges that you see that'll need to be solved by governments and individuals?
Fundamentally, we have to have a renegotiation of the social contract. I might as well just be spewing out 4-letter words when I say that because it offends people so much. But we have two choices here. We either go into this and say we have to remodel, remake for a new age, or we can simply bury our heads in the sand and do nothing and watch the system collapse. Or as a colleague of mine suggested just a few weeks ago, well, we can just keep printing money. We're doing that anyway. All that does is kick the can down the road and cause the systems to become, quite frankly, even less stable than they are today. So doing nothing does mean collapse at some point. And I think older populations have to ask themselves if they believe that's really fair for their kids and their grandkids and perhaps even future generations. Is it fair? My answer to that is no, it's not fair. If we're going to have a social welfare program, it's a social welfare program for all, not just for the people who happen to be there already. I certainly think that, and not to get into politics of things, but when we look at healthcare costs in particular, part of the reason why Medicare is so expensive is because Medicare only applies to an older population that on average does get sicker at a higher rate than younger populations do. If we wanted to improve costs within the healthcare system, then, for example, a Medicare for all approach where everyone is insured is a better option because young and old even out the actuarial predictions and the cost of the system. That's a good thing. But these are really caustic conversations to have with public policymakers in particular because older people vote and they vote in large numbers. And because of the nature of our political system, they're more concentrated in rural areas. in smaller states, and these smaller states have a greater say in the political conversations in this country today. It just is what it is. It's a fact. So undoing that, yeah, I think it's when it's going to come under threat that we're going to actually have that conversation about what to do. And that's about 12 years away before it really starts feeling it, when payments start to shift in Social Security. 2034, I think, is that magic number.
So what will retirement look like in the future?
Won't look like it does today. It's already changing. People do seem to want to work longer, but retirement as retirement, it just won't look like your mom and dad's or your grandparents. I think it's very likely that things like a gap year will become more commonplace, where perhaps you exit your legacy career for a year or two and then go back to work in either part-time or full-time job, perhaps the gig economy. I think that that's entirely possible. You know, men derive a lot of value from paid work. They like doing it. Women, you know, I think probably enter retirement better than men because they have, you know, better attachment to the community, better attachment to friend groups that aren't necessarily exclusively tied to work. But I think people will go in and out more often. They'll choose your own adventure, I think, will be what we see with the wealthier populations. They're already doing it now. Choose your own adventure in retirement. My dad, for example, he's a doctor and he all but exited the workforce during the pandemic. And because my brother, who runs the company, is struggling now to find workers, he's re-entering. That will be probably a lot more commonplace for a larger and more diverse set of people in economic conditions. We can expect that will happen. But we're already starting to see, you know, how older people are rethinking later life. Older people always take a hammering during a bad economy. It's just one of those consistent things that we always see. And I like to say that it's usually not just because of ageism, it's because of costs. You know, so you have to look at it from both angles, but it's still a caustic mix. You know, it's the short-term gain that might sacrifice a long-term need. That being said, if an older person is let go or leaves, it takes them twice as long to get back in, and they usually earn half as much as they did before. It's, again, it's just reality. Doesn't happen to everybody. These are averages, but they are averages that folks should know. During the pandemic, we had an excess number of retirements, which is well documented now. But we didn't see an uptick in the number of claims for Social Security. So what that suggests is that there might be a number of people that are simply waiting on the sidelines to say, maybe I should get back in. Maybe it's my time once the pandemic wanes. Maybe they had savings, you know, maybe they took the pandemic stimulus funds and put them away. Maybe they're drawing a bit on their 401k. That's all entirely possible. But what we do know is that those Social Security claims did not go up with the number of people in quote-unquote retirement. But that's how they're reporting themselves to the government. Now, another thing that we know, which is actually really exciting and something that my team picked apart just recently, is that we're starting to see real growth in the gig economy with older workers in the gig economy. And it's one of those things, like if you look around, if you're in an urban environment for sure, and probably suburban as well, if you look around, all of a sudden, delivery drivers look a little bit older. Uber drivers look a little bit older. And a number of us have been trying to figure out what the number is, and we dug it up. And today, 20% of gig workers are over the age of 50, and a full third of those are over the age of 65. So that's about 10 million and 3 million, respectively. That's sizable. That's sizable against the total country. And I think it suggests a future where more and more of us in later life will be enjoying gig work. Do it on your own when you want to versus being locked down to a desk for 8 hours a day.
I love the choose your own adventure version of retirement, the coming in and out.
Yeah, but I think it's not just, again, it's not just your retirement, it's your life. There's going to be a lot more opportunities to pick and choose. And that there are benefits and drawbacks to that as well. Obviously, Joe, you know, one of the great things about full-time employment is that you're paying into Social Security. Mm-hmm. You're paying into government benefits. Well, you don't always do that in gig work. You don't necessarily have a 401k. So there are drawbacks to it. But, you know, if you're in that post-65 period and you have a pension, you have retirement savings, that's a nice way to supplant your earnings for sure. And it's definitely a great way to stay engaged with the community, both as an earner and as a participant in the fabric of life. And again, there's good news here. It's not just all about dollars and cents. You know, people who stay engaged and work for longer periods of time are healthier. They're physically more fit. They're cognitively more fit. They're mentally sound. There's not the same levels of depression. They're less at risk for isolation or dementia. All of this stuff plays in. So going to work has to have the same kind of output as like getting on the bike or taking a walk every day. It's good for you. It's good for you, just like eating an apple a day. And more people should embrace that. And gig work allows you to, like I said, choose your own adventure. You're allowed to kind of do it at your own pace versus being forced into the same routine every day throughout your life.
One thing I noticed in recent months, to your point on the excess retirements during the pandemic, was there were two analyses, one by the Kansas City Fed offhand and one by the St. Louis Fed. And they found actually the interesting stat is that there was a decline in unretirements, the people who are retired returning to the workforce, which previously was about 20% of people coming back within the first 5 years. And it leads me to ask you this question about with the choose your own adventure, with the coming in and out, completely agree, see it. A lot of the clients I work with are doing that already. What do people need to be thinking about at the individual level to prepare for that type of world where you're going to have the different chapters, sometimes work, sometimes not, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, you always have to have that rainy day fund. I mean, that's, we say it 1,000 times over, you've got to have the rainy day fund. You've got to have that retirement savings really built up. And you really have to do that from day one. So I, just like many young people, delayed starting to save and put money away because I was young, I was starting out, I needed all the cash. Well, you know, Susie Orman points to what you can do with just $100 a day, $100 a month early on, the multiplier effect. That really needs to be hammered into people's heads because most folks are going to need about $1 million to retire. It's an average figure. Obviously, some are going to need more, some are going to need a little bit less, but $1 million is the fairly magic number that folks agree to. That being said, making sure that you have the right pieces in place to take a step back sure helps out a lot, whether you put money aside for education or you're just mentally prepared for the shifts. I am a strong believer in lifelong education. A lot of companies offer education in-house. Take those classes, take those courses. They're free. They're giving them to you. I mean, it's the best way you can keep up on your skills. There's plenty of things you can do, obviously, within the community. Community colleges, for example, are a great resource that people should be leaning into on a regular basis. But be prepared for disruptions. The lives that our parents and our grandparents led, where they were in work for 30 years, sometimes or more with the same company, that's gone by the wayside. I think it might be coming back to some degree because I think that the relationship between the employer and the employee is changing right now fundamentally, but it's not back yet. So you have to be prepared. You have to build up your own defenses for what the future may bring.
So you mentioned the gig economy, and you write a lot in your book about another alternative path that is really attractive for some people as they approach later life, mid to later life, and that's entrepreneurship. And I'm wondering, what do you see happening there? What are some of the pros and cons for people considering that option?
Well, I think it's important that we level set what entrepreneurship is, because entrepreneurship is a big word and it scares the heck out of people. Entrepreneurship is as simple as, you know, putting your own shingle up. It's the same as being part of the gig economy to an extent, whether or not you're on a platform like Fiverr or Etsy as a craft maker. Maybe you're selling on Amazon or eBay, like you're a small business then. And most people, I think, most average everyday Americans don't think of that as entrepreneurship. They think of that as opening a small business or working in a part-time job. But when you incorporate, when you start doing that work on your own, you are an entrepreneur by definition. So there are some things to watch out for, obviously. Individuals have to consider the financial risks involved. And this is always a messy area because the risk can be very high. Dipping into 401k, dipping into savings is really a no-no. Try to avoid it as much as possible because you won't have enough time to make it back if you lose it. And as I mentioned, it's a lot harder to get a job later in life too. So if you're earning less and having to work later in life, that's not necessarily the ideal scenario to be in. Obviously, there are programs that are out there through the Small Business Administration that certainly can help people understand this path to entrepreneurship, pardon me. But the big thing is, at the end of the day, is to do your homework, just like anything else. Now, here's the good news. There's always good news. The good news is that older entrepreneurs, older small business owners, tend to do better than younger peers on average. That's because you've taken all of this life experience, as well as this degree of caution, and you're applying it to your product at the end of the day. So where you may not be Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg, you could have a very successful and profitable company in just a few years. But don't overextend. Don't overextend, and don't throw good money after bad.
Sound advice on both sides of that equation, and appreciate your level setting. So I've heard a lot about the scientific advancements in longevity. Very exciting, sounds promising. But you note there's a gap, there's another big challenge that's connected to that, and that's attitudes. Attitudes will have to change in the future. How will attitudes need to be different in this super age era of longer lives?
In the 20th century in particular, first of all, I should mention that if there's one consistency throughout all of human history, it's our inconsistent attitudes towards older populations. As a general rule, if you were wealthy and male, you held a pretty nice position, no matter what your age. The Roman Senate was designed of old men. Romans celebrated the 50th birthday for men. But if you were female, if you were poor, if you were of color, you know, the path isn't quite the same. And that creates some gaps across the board. So in America today, at least, white, cisgendered, gay men earn the most on average. No disputing that. Asian women, though, they live the longest, but they don't earn the same amount. And trans women of color earn well below the poverty line and have a life expectancy that hovers around the traditional life expectancy, which is around 35 years. These are significant gaps amongst populations. There's just no other way to cut it. So we have to tackle some inequalities up front in terms of kind of getting ahead of this. But in terms of the long life perspective, we have in the 20th century really leaned into this idea of youthism, youth above all. And it bleeds into just about everything we do. So whether or not we like to admit it, we're all ageist. We are all ageist. We may not be ageist, but we are ageist. And that can come across as both explicit and implicit bias. It can be out front, making jokes at the expense of people who are older than you, or it can be internalized. Regardless, it's a terribly detrimental bias that, frankly, we seem to just embrace. So we have to start breaking free of that. And I think part of the way we're going to be breaking free from that is the fact that there just are going to be a lot more old people around, a lot more older people around. And we'll have no choice but to see their value. We'll have no choice but to sell to them if we want to grow our companies. And when that happens, it'll start ironing out some of the wrinkles, no pun intended, ironing out some of the wrinkles to get us to a place where ageism or thinking of older people in the negative may not be as normalized as it is today. And this, again, is where demographics play a big role. Obviously, the boomers came first, this massive bulge of people. We had a slight correction during Gen X, and then this massive explosion during the millennials. Gen Z, a contraction again. Well, there's nothing coming behind them. It's a further contraction. Gen Alpha has been in essentially constant decline year-on-year birth rates. And in fact, 2020 was our lowest birth rate on record. And we only improved last year by 0.1%. That spells out that we are going to have no choice as a nation and as economy but to include older people, but to address our ageist attitudes. And in doing so, we often have to start with ourselves. Take away those pejoratives. I lose my keys all the time. I have lost my keys my entire lifetime. I am not having a senior moment. I'm having a moment. I just do that. And a lot of us have those tells. I think even the oldest old have a role in this. I often tell the story of my grandfather, Thomas Bury, who at 90 years old, kept calling the man who was a month older than him across the hall in the nursing home, that old guy across the hall. Like, we have to wipe that away. We have to get away from that, because if we don't, it's just going to cause further harm. And I'm no Pollyanna. I know that these things don't go away overnight. Age bias has been around with us as a species since day one. You know, it's one of the oldest words in our language. And we really set up our systems during the earliest days of civilization to separate young and old people. So it's not going away overnight, but we do have to be aware of what we should be doing to get ahead.
Absolutely. I have come to refer to it as I'm having a keys moment.
Exactly. And that's why I'm so thankful for things that can help me find them, because I'd always throw them down.
Yes,
that's a habit I'm not going to change.
I have a tile on mine. I have to get the newer Apple one, but it's one of those constant challenges, as you mentioned, for all generations. So, new topic. I've always learned a lot from listeners to this podcast, because many of them email me with comments and suggestions, and they're almost always really helpful. And I had an email exchange with one person recently who pointed out that not everyone listening to the podcast is straight and or married. Some have long distance relationships. Some are single, solo agers. But she was encouraging me to explore retirement for a diverse audience. And I'm wondering if you could opine on what do you see as the challenges faced by the LGBTQ+ community with retirement today? And how might things evolve from here in the super age?
Well, I mean, I think I've alluded to it. There is incredible diversity in our longevity experiences, the lives that we're afforded to live, how we're able to earn. The systems that we have today, although they have been adjusted to some degree, only recently took into account marriages of LGBT people. Our longevity has always been, at least in my lifetime, has always been in flux. So, you know, when I was 16 years old, I went to go see Rent. I was just kind of figuring out my sexuality. And I left it in tears because I saw what my future looked like, and it was grim. It was grim, man. I mean, 40 years old, maybe if I was lucky, I would survive too. So I didn't have the same attitudes towards savings in my younger years as I do today. Well, now the chance of getting HIV is relatively low if you're taking the right precautions. But there are some underlying truths here that do seem to magnify within the LGBT community. So like I said, white, cis, gay men are earning at an incredibly high rate. Lesbians earn far less than gay men. Far, 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 far less than gay men. And trans people and trans women of color in particular, they really do earn the least. And their life expectancy is really cut short. So strategies are different because of these inherent realities. Obviously, there are things that we have to take on from a macro perspective, but from an individual perspective, understanding that these things are there, fighting against them when you can, but planning, that's a key component of it. You know, in the District of Columbia in Washington, where I live, what you see is that community kind of comes together, especially within the gay male community here. So 17th Street, which is just a few blocks from my house, it really is a living retirement community, or what most in the business would call a naturally occurring retirement community. These men live in apartments for the most part. They come downstairs each day for breakfast and lunch at one of the local cafes, dinner too, and they have services delivered into their home, perhaps from a long-term care community, or the savvy ones today are using apps just like the rest of us. So each person really needs to consider whether you're straight, gay, trans, whether you're coupled or not, what your potential really looks like, what your realities really look like at all times. And you do have to do kind of a regular adjustment, you know, every 5 to 10 years. Where are my goals? Where am I going? Because obviously, if you marry later in life, which many people are doing today, or having children later in life, which is becoming far more common, certainly within the LGBT community, well into your 40s or even 50s, a number of friends have had their first children in their 50s now. That changes the equation on what your retirement prospects really look like. So this is a very long-winded way of saying, take a look at yourself and your actual needs. Take a look at yourself and your actual financial realities and your prospects. If you're a woman, please, 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 please plan on living longer than you think. If you're a man, you're probably going to live a little shorter than you expect. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be planning for at least the average plus plus, especially if you have some extra money, because money typically correlates with longevity.
Appreciate that. So looking at from the business side, two questions. First one is about companies. So how will the policies and programs and practices of companies, talk about the system, need to change to be able to attract, retain, and develop a more diverse workforce, age-diverse workforce?
Well, I think first companies obviously have to realize that they need that. And if you take a look into some leading companies overseas, they've already embraced it. I talk in the book about Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, BMW as being real leaders here, who said, we need older workers to survive and to thrive. And the empathy of having older people around, older workers around, actually bleeds into the work product. It builds a better product at the end of the day, and a product that is, and services, right, quite frankly, that are more inclusive, and more people like them because of that. They're not universally designed, but they're awfully close. They're considering a diverse set of needs. Companies always have to consider getting age diversity in, because we know that diversity helps companies do better. In fact, age diversity in a 2013 study in Germany showed across 147 different companies that yes, age diversity was actually good for the bottom line. We know that it's the case. It's not a secret. The problem is that all too often, the people who are making hiring decisions within companies fall right in the middle of the bell curve. They're 35 to 50 years old, and they're often hiring for people who look like them. And it's no surprise, because of that, the highest rates of ageism, reported ageism within the workplace, are older workers and younger workers. Yes, we can be ageist against the young. So what can businesses really do to tackle this? Well, the first thing they have to do is, like I said, they have to understand that there's a problem. They have to understand that there's a weakness, an Achilles heel to their enterprise. The second thing they have to do is really address the recruitment issues. How are you talking to people within your advertisements? Are you saying recent grad? Well, you've knocked out most of the population there when you say recent grad. You also knock out significant parts of the population when you attach number of years. Number of years experience. Well, if you have 25 years experience in the workforce, but maybe only 3 years in a certain field, what kind of experience do you have? There are certain businesses that post that they offer meals at work. And for some individuals, especially older workers or workers that need flexibility, that suggests that you're going to be at the office all the time. So businesses would do right by paying attention to the coded language they're putting out there in their recruitment practices. They also need to get out of this mindset. And I've seen it firsthand, managers who are afraid of older people because they might be smarter. They might have more experience. I've actually seen men and women not get interviews because of that. And it's really disturbing to me. I'm like, if you've got the right experience and you've got the right drive, give it to me. Like, give me all of that. Like, I came in the workforce into the 1990s, which was the lowest point of participation rate for older workers. And to this day, I feel robbed. I feel absolutely robbed that I didn't get that mentorship, be able to suck up all that great intellect. I worked with people who were like 45 to 50. Like, those were the old folks in work. Businesses also just need to adapt how they're designing jobs now. And the Great Resignation is helping to push that forward, because across the board, older people, younger people, everyone in between, we all want flexibility. We all want flexibility at work. That's easier said than done in some cases, but it is doable. It can be done. And remote work, in particular for the knowledge economy, remote work proves that it can be done. No more excuses anymore. We also need to make sure that individuals have access to caregiving leave, whether that be some financial support, but more importantly, time. Like, more and more of us are going to take greater and greater roles in taking care of our parents and our children and possibly our grandchildren. Give employees that flexibility wherever you can. Education, ergonomics are central to any kind of good business practice today. But really, I think one thing all businesses have to consider, because there are five generations now in the workforce, to get them really humming, get them really working, to be intentional about pulling them together, is that we have to agree on technologies, get people upskilled to use them, or skilled period to use them, so that we can communicate better. Because time and time again, that's where things fall off the rails, is when communications break down.
My other business question is, there's obviously, as you mentioned, a big need for new innovative products and services as people live longer. What are the areas that you see that are most promising, and what are some that aren't really getting enough attention that should be?
I mean, anything in mobility today is a good thing, because mobility is one of the first things to go. So I am really impressed by companies like Tesla, any company that's doing self-driving vehicles, I think is amazing. Bravo to them. There are a number of companies that, car companies in particular, that are taking into account health monitoring within the vehicle. Health monitoring really is a huge field right now, especially for this new emerging class of people that I call the middle plus. They sit between, you know, classic retirement and classic adulthood. They are in this no man's land, but probably the best period of life because they're still economically connected. They're physically, mentally, cognitively fit. They're curious. They're digitally literate. Like, they have money. You know, they have all of these things and they're active consumers. They are looking at things like their health as being very important to them. That's part of the reason why the Apple Watch is so successful today. It's a great health monitoring device packaged in a beautifully cool looking product. I think Peloton, I mentioned in my book, is a great one. Car companies, like I said, I think retail environments have to adapt and are adapting coming out of COVID to be more inclusive and more considerate of change and changing lifestyles in later life. But if there's any single thing that really jumps out there to me, I think this breaking free of this idea of building just for old is something that is quickly fading away. Because old people tell us time and time again, don't build for me, build with me in mind. And again, it goes to that idea that we want to be part of a tribe. People think this concept is revolutionary, but at the end of the day, we're all human. And the second we begin to other people, it has negative consequences. Like, bring people along. Like, so what if the product doesn't get them to where an average user would get to? It helps them along and they feel part of the pack at the end of the day. That's a good thing. That's a good thing that we should really do and more companies should get behind. I think that there are areas, of course, that are entirely disruptable right now, areas where we haven't put quite enough attention. In fact, within my own enterprise, we've launched a subsidiary called Kiba that's focused on inclusive design in the built environment because built environments are really hostile to people. They are really hostile and they get more hostile the older you get. They get more hostile the more deficiencies you have, perhaps in your vision or your hearing or your mobility. So there's a lot of little things that we can do to make the built environment better. And guess who's paying money to travel? Older populations. Hotels are a constant barrier to a good vacation. It's hard to get into the shower. It's hard to get into the bed. It's hard to see at night. Like, these are things that we can adjust that are literally sitting right in front of us. So it doesn't have to necessarily be the brand new shiny nickel, but it does need to be tiny, tiny pieces here and there. I think housing later in life is probably one of the bigger ones that we're going to see change. I think the nursing home model, while we won't go away, people are going to be looking at different options. I think if you take a look at Upside Home or Papa, two South Florida-based companies that are either working on companionship or finding people housing, co-housing, these are companies that are exciting to me because they're offering people an alternate path forward. Obviously, I think, as I alluded to earlier, seeing how families are cobbling together services now through apps for their loved ones who may need care or may need some supportive services is awesome. Like, it's cool, but it's also being done because they have to. They don't have a choice. And necessity has always been the mother of invention.
So you mentioned at the very beginning, Japan, and I'm just wondering briefly, what can we learn from Japan?
We can learn a lot of what to do and a lot of what not to do. I mean, comparing Japan to the United States is a lot like comparing apples to oranges. Like, they're both countries, but they're very different countries. Japan is a monoculture. It's a monoculture that's very proud of its monoculture. America is not. We are a mixing pot of cultures, and some of us celebrate this. I am one of those people, but the systems work differently. We're a country of immigrants. They are not. So our labor market looks a lot different. So whereas Japan, you know, is in this contraction, they're losing population. The United States, even with our abysmal birth rates, we're going to continue to grow because of immigration. So our solutions are to our challenges are quite different. Japan, though, has done some really forward-thinking stuff around the use of robotics and the use of artificial intelligence. And while seeing those two things in a nursing home are a bit jarring, that I think nursing homes should be very human-centric, very touch-centric, they are using them because they don't have a lot of choice. They have to find efficiencies in the system for the system to function. Where I think that they're really leading the way is in extending working lives, especially for people who might be in middle or blue collar type jobs. And Japan has really led the world in the development of exoskeletons in particular that allow laborers to extend their working lives because they can pick up items that are heavier for longer periods of time. But they also have this added benefit of helping younger workers too, because if younger workers are wearing exoskeletons for repetitive work, they reduce the strain on their body over time. So that, again, extends the amount of time a body can be used in physical labor. So there are quite a bit of things that we can learn from Japan today. Another one is, of course, the retail environment, which I think is highly disruptible at this point. And they're one of their retail groups, Aeon, which is a bit like Simon Mall Properties across the US, is that they've taken a number of these shopping centers and they've turned them into grand generation malls. That's what they call them. And they've really turned the focus away from children and onto older populations. And it's all across the board in these retail environments. Cafes are different. The reading spaces are different. There's different ways to exercise. The types of programming that's brought in is different. The cultural programming is different. But what the outcome is on average a 10% increase in return on investment on annual revenues at these places. And that's a good thing for a business, especially when you're staring down the barrel of a gun that says that this neighborhood or your country is going to be in decline and you're able to pull more revenue out of it. That's pretty remarkable. So we can learn from these things in Japan. But our realities at the end of the day are just a little bit different.
So if readers can take away three messages from your Super Age book, and I know there are many more, which three would you want them to be?
Probably the first one, the first and foremost one, is that change is inevitable and it's here. And we have one of two options. We lean into it or we hide from it. The second is hiding from it will only cause things to fall apart. Pretending the change does not exist will cause the systems that we really hold near and dear to our heart to collapse. And the third is that opportunity exists everywhere in periods of change. And fortune has always favored the brave, has favored individuals who have said, okay, this is my reality, this is our reality, or this is the reality that's coming, and we can adjust to meet the demands of tomorrow. So with those three things in mind, I have a very optimistic view of our future because I think that historically, humans, and certainly from an American perspective, when opportunity presents itself, we really lean into it. So I think this could be a very great period for us. It'll also allow us to embrace some things that we've shied away from for a long period of time, including questions of equity and inclusion. And if we do lean in, this could be a golden period for us. So I look on the bright side for this at the end of the day.
And there's always that bright side. And a lot of it is up to what people do individually, as well as what we do collectively. So thank you so much, Bradley, for sharing all of your insights and a lot of factual wisdom on what's ahead.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate you having me today.
Thanks again.
Well, we certainly covered a lot of ground in a whirlwind conversation ranging from self-driving cars to new housing options through the country of Japan and hither and yon with Bradley Sherman. So I jotted down a number of notes and I'd like to share three takeaways. I'm sure you have your own things that got your attention. Here are my three. Number one, choose your own adventure. In the future, and there already are today, lots of options to consider in terms of how retirement's going to go for you. I think the important thing is to think about what's retirement going to be like for you? What do you want it to be like? And most important, what do you need to be doing now to create and be ready for that option or options? Number two, be flexible. That refers to two things. It seems like we're coming into a more flexible future because flexibility, as he noted, is something that's prized by all generations. And we've certainly seen that coming out of the pandemic. I'm hopeful we're coming out of the pandemic. I know that's a question. But what would flexibility look like for you in that phase of life? If you are to continue to work in some way, what's it going to look like? And I think often be flexible in how you're thinking about retirement is valuable, meaning there's a lot of talk about retirement is all or nothing. I'll never retire, I never can retire, or I'm going right to all retirement, no work in any way. It forgets and leaves out the middle, semi-retirement, which is much more customizable. It seems like that's going to be part of the future, along with what he mentioned, the coming in and out of work and education, lifelong learning, et cetera. What's that going to look like for you? Number three, embrace change. As he noted, it's inevitable. So it's best to accept it and then take it a step further. How can you really anticipate it, make the most of it, and be ahead of the curve? So I mentioned that I had a number of great emails from listeners with suggestions and constructive comments. I welcome them. If you have some suggestions or comments, please send them my way. I'll have the email in the show notes, but it's all lowercase, joec@retirementwisdom.com. And if you're a new listener, keep in mind you can look at all of our previous episodes on our website, organized by season, and you may take a look at them and find something that really interests you in terms of either a guest and or a topic. You can find that at retirementwisdom.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.